Thank you, Tom. You know, over the years, I've introduced a few big-name journalists to this club. They all made me proud of my former profession. Today, I'm delighted to reintroduce one of them. Peter Copeland, who for the last 14 years until 4 weeks ago headed the Washington Bureau for the E.W. Scripps Company's TV stations, websites, and newspapers, including the Naples Daily News. Peter retired on December 31 to start his own media consulting business. He was last here after the first Gulf War. After his talk, the women wanted to meet him, and the men wanted him to meet their daughters. 23 years later, he's still the bright, articulate, boyishly handsome, non-swearing, non-smoking, non-drinking, always smiling fellow whom everyone loves. Sounds boring, doesn't it? By the way, he comes by all of that honestly. We are pleased to have as the club's guests today Peter's mother, Julie Morley, and his aunt, Molly Walbaum. Please stand so we can welcome you. Peter's a whole lot more than good-looking, bright, and likable. He has a better handle on what's broken in Washington than most, and he has covered military and foreign affairs long enough to have a world view. He started his post-Lawrence University journalism career as a night police reporter in Chicago, moved to a Scripps paper in El Paso where he covered the Mexican border issues, spent 5 years covering Latin America, 5 more on the Pentagon beat, including distinguished reporting during the U.S. invasion of Panama, the first Gulf War, and the intervention in Somalia. Peter's wartime stories were good reads. One led to one of his 4 books, She Went to War, the story of then-Army Major Rhonda Cornum, a flight surgeon whose helicopter was shot down during the first Gulf War, who then fought hard despite 2 broken arms, a broken finger, and a bullet wound in the back, was captured, sexually abused, but still was the effective ranking officer and leader of the captives. By the way, Brigadier General Cornum just retired from the Army last year, completing a distinguished career. The headlines recently about Defense Secretary Leon Panetta allowing women in combat would be a little late to the party if you ask General Cornum. Peter hates to brag, but he loves to tell how he was sent to Mexico to get stories and came back with a beautiful Mexican wife. His wife, Maru Montero, who runs a Latin dance company, is really something special, and I'm sorry she couldn't be here with us today. Then there's his story of how his accurate reporting on different topics on the same day got him kicked out of the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City. Then Ambassador John Gavin, the actor, you will remember, was angry that Peter reported on his imperious management style, and almost expelled from the country by the Mexican government for reporting accurately about voter fraud. He is happy to talk about the food stamp fraud and how the Social Security Administration wrongfully declared people dead that his investigative teams uncovered last year, leading to congressional hearings and reforms in both programs. Good old-fashioned watchdog journalism. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome back to our podium Peter Copeland.
Thank you. Thank you. That was nice. Thank you. Thanks a lot, Ellen. That's I should really just sit down, no? Thank you also, Tom, for your hospitality, and Ellie and the Forum Club. The high school students that are here, it's nice to see you, and maybe we can talk afterwards. You all must have it pretty together if you're at an event like this and you can get up and stand and speak in front of everybody. That's great. And the one thing that you should know, that I'll give you advice as an old guy, and I'm going to ask advice from the people in the audience about me, but you can't possibly have it all figured out at this point. That you all seem to have a direction where you're headed, and it's great, but it'll change, and it'll be better. Right, everybody? And then I want to thank also my mom for being here and my Aunt Molly. So that's special for me, too. Alan was a terrific boss when we were at Scripps together, and his wife, Bev, who's here, was also very supportive of me and my family. And before Alan became a big muckety-muck in Scripps Howard, he was the Pentagon reporter in the Washington Bureau, the job that I held also. And before us, the greatest Pentagon correspondent of Scripps Howard, Ernie Pyle. When I became the Pentagon reporter, his job at the time was in senior management, and his responsibility basically was to maximize shareholder value. But all it seemed to me that he cared about were stories. And he would always call me up with story ideas that were most of the time pretty good. The other thing that he did for me was something that most reporters don't do, that he passed on some of his sources, which we usually guard closely. But some of the young officers that he knew covering the Pentagon, by the time I got there, now they were generals and running the place. So it was a good introduction for me. Alan also always said that a good reporter could do anything in life because you know how to ask questions and you know how to listen. And that's proved true in his case. Alan's also, as you all probably know, super organized. So it was a year ago that he asked me to come back to the Forum Club and speak. And he said it was going to be on January 25th. So I grabbed the newspaper, New York Times, January 25th, 2012. So exactly a year ago. Put it away in an envelope, like a time capsule. So I just took it out. So you can see it's kind of yellow, but headlines. Obama sets goal of economy built for the long run. So emphasis on the long. A couple other headlines in here. Gingrich tries to lure Tea Party support in Florida. At that point, you might remember Gingrich was really the hot challenger. Another headline, Union seeks to turn Hispanics against Romney. That definitely worked. And then the last one, this is a classic, which they could run again today. Americans divided over tax policy. So it was more than 20 years ago that I was here. I came with my family, my wife and our baby daughter, who was... And now she'll be mad at me, but she looked like a meatball in this little red and white check bathing suit. She was about this big. And I remember splashing in the pool and going to the beautiful beach here. So now she's almost finished with university at Northwestern University. We have a son who's a senior in high school. I was a young reporter, never thought about management. Now I've had enough management for a lifetime. And I do want to, speaking of management and Scripps, I do have to give a shout out to the Naples Daily News. It's so great to be a newspaper person and to come to Naples. It's like going to Fantasy Island. Because like Tom mentioned, the paper's so fat. So, as you might imagine, being in Washington, it can be wearying to cover people day in and day out who lie, cheat, defraud the public, make up stories out of whole cloth. And that's just the sports pages. So, I have two things I want to do today. First, I want to share what I've learned in nearly 25 years in Washington. And then second, while I'm here in Naples, I want to turn to you for some personal help and guidance. This is really something that I'm going through that I need help with. And I'm going to save that for last. But in terms of Washington, at the start of President Obama's second term, I'm going to talk about three things. Actually, as an aside, When Alan called, I said, oh, January 25th, I can talk about the new Republican administration. So I want to talk about domestic policy and Obama too, America's position in the world, and politics in general. And then finally, I'm going to talk about a subject that's close to my heart and important to the country, and that is, what the heck is wrong with the news media? And how can we become better informed citizens? So the first thing on America's agenda, regardless of what the president or the Republicans want, is the economy. The economy is number one on the agenda because it's the root of much of what ails us. Now, we all know that money can't buy love or even happiness, but it definitely makes all the other problems easier. So remember the fiscal cliff? That turned out to be a speed bump that they just rolled right over. We survived a little clarity on taxes, no spending cuts, but now there are three more big deadlines coming up. Just this week, Congress managed to push off the disagreement over the debt ceiling. Then they have to figure out how to manage a large set of budget cuts that are programmed in called sequestration, part of earlier budget deals. And then the third deadline is that the funding for the current operations of the government will run out shortly. So we're going to have a lot of discussion soon about shutting down the government again. So most of the economic debate in Washington is about what the government should or shouldn't do, spending, taxes. This is natural, probably, but even if Washington today started producing balanced budgets, it wouldn't fix the economy the way it is. In fact, I think of it the other way around, that if we can turn around the economy, that will drive growth, produce more tax revenue, reduce spending because people will have jobs. They won't need unemployment. So growing the economy will go a long way towards getting the government back in line. And it will put people back to work, give them money to spend, and it will improve the returns for retirees who depend on pensions, investments, and Social Security. I think you can actually make a case now that it's not the right time to cut spending, even if you think the spending is out of whack, like I do. What the government can do easily now is be more predictable, even if it runs a deficit. A big drag on the market is the uncertainty. The reason that companies are holding back investing and keeping cash is the uncertainty in Washington. Lurching from crisis to crisis is the absolute worst thing they could do for us. So I don't disagree that the government is spending beyond its means, and the spending driven by healthcare is going up too fast. But in the past 2 years, we've had two rounds of budget cuts and one set of tax hikes just this last New Year's. Government spending is 24% of the gross domestic product. That's above the post-war average of about 20, but it's not extreme compared to the average. Okay, some statistics, sorry. Debt as a percentage of GDP is about 74%. That's twice what it was in 1965, so it's a lot. If we keep going like this in 10 years, the debt will be about 90% of GDP. And that's a lot also, but it's not Greece, or it's not collapse. So in addition to the economy, President Obama has set out some goals of his own for the final 4 years. One that's in the news most recently is a surprise in that it wasn't discussed at all during the campaign, and that's gun control. It wasn't mentioned in the campaign, but the school shootings in Newtown had a profound effect on the president. He met with the parents afterwards, and he asked them to bring photos of their kids and tell stories about their kids. And people who saw him afterwards said that he was weeping. And he's a good dad and is very engaged in raising their daughters. As an aside, Sasha and Malia, they go to school in our neighborhood just down the street from us. And I have my kids, since they were babies, trained to be on the lookout for news. And that they're there to alert me when something happens. So one day I get this frantic text from my son. Something's happening in the neighborhood, that there's feds, as he calls them, police all over, bomb squad, canine patrols, snipers, guys in SWAT suits. And so I'm thinking, okay, thank you, hang on. So I call the White House, go online, try to figure out what it is. It was not serious. It was Mr. and Mrs. Obama going to school for a parent-teacher conference. So I texted my son, you can stand down, but thank you. And he texts back, and he goes, wow, they must have terrible report cards. So I think we'll get some kind of gun control out of this period. Probably a limit on, maybe a limit on assault rifles, maybe a limit on the size of magazines, probably, most likely, increased requirements for purchasing a handgun. And none of those will stop a mass shooter intent on hurting people and killing himself. But it might make it harder for a convicted criminal to go buy a gun in a store. Another item on the agenda that wasn't part of the campaign is immigration. And what changed here is Election Day, when the Republicans got only 30% of the Hispanic vote. Even though many Republicans believe that they are the party of family values, party of economic opportunity, and they should be attractive to Hispanics. They think that they ought to be. So there's always been two parts to the immigration debate. The first part is to how to keep out the people that we don't want to come. And then the second part is what to do about the people that are here now illegally. The stereotype is always that conservatives worry most about the border blocking people, and that liberals worry most about the people that are here giving them amnesty. The stereotype is not really true. Many conservatives are worried now that we don't have enough young workers to support an aging population. So they favor some sort of work program to allow people to come here and work and then go back home and commute, basically. At the same time, President Obama, a liberal, has deported and is deporting more people every month than any president in U.S. history. He's increased the immigration enforcement program so much that it's now the biggest single federal law enforcement expense, bigger than all the other federal agencies in law enforcement combined. So the trickiest part is what to do with the 11 million people estimated who are here illegally. Most of them are law-abiding, good citizens. They're our neighbors. But it goes against our sense of fairness to let them skip ahead of the line because they broke the law either coming here or staying here when they weren't supposed to. So I'm looking at Senator Marco Rubio, your senator, as somebody that might be able to pull us out of this dilemma. He's talking about making people current on their taxes, making sure that they haven't broken any laws, any beyond the immigration laws, pay some sort of penalty, and then become legal residents, not citizens. But then down the road, figure out a way to talk about citizenship. So after gun control, immigration, President Obama announced that he wants to put climate change back on the agenda. And by climate change, what he means is reducing the use of oil and coal. And that seems to me very, very difficult when we're trying to get the economy up. Even in good times, it would be difficult. But that's something that he wants to put on the agenda. So those are some of the domestic issues. On foreign policy, when he campaigned the first time, Barack Obama said he wanted to improve America's image abroad. That he was not going to be a polarizing figure, a hated figure, he said, like George Bush around the world. That he was the younger Bush. That actually, President Obama admires the foreign policy of President Bush Sr., not Jr. President Obama was the son of an African, son of a world-traveling mother. He lived in Indonesia. He was very knowledgeable about the world. He didn't look like other U.S. presidents. He thought that he would have more empathy and understanding around the world. So how did this work? His personal popularity is high overseas. But I don't think America's standing has improved. This reminds me of another joke. Two reporters, an American reporter and a reporter from a dictatorship. The American reporter says, "I have complete freedom of the press. I can say anything I want about the President of the United States." And the reporter from the dictatorship says, "I have complete freedom of the press, too. I can say anything I want about the President of the United States." So President Obama did follow through on his promise to get out of Iraq, and he's on track to wind down the war in Afghanistan, which is now the longest war in U.S. history. Here's a sobering statistic that I saw in the Washington Post the other day. In 2012, more U.S. military personnel died from suicide than from combat. But the man who criticized the war on terror, President Obama, has expanded that war into Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and now Mali. His weapon of choice is the Predator drone, a precision killing machine that can be flown from a base thousands of miles away. Across the Middle East and North Africa, the White House policy was to, quote, lead from behind. Dictators, one an ally, one an enemy, fell in Egypt and Libya. The dictator in Syria is still in power, bombing residential neighborhoods. The death toll there is 60,000 at least. We're leading so far behind that we were surprised when terrorists attacked the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. We were surprised when the French president sent troops to Mali. We were surprised again when terrorists took American hostages in Algeria, and surprised again when the Algerian government went in with guns blazing. If anything, the new foreign policy team in the second administration is less inclined to become involved overseas than in the first administration. Chuck Hagel, nominee for Secretary of Defense, John Kerry, nominee for State, their worldviews were shaped by combat experience in Vietnam. John Brennan is the new leader of the named to be the new leader of the CIA. He didn't serve in the military, but spent his entire career in the clandestine service at CIA. And he's the person behind the secret drone campaign run out of the White House. So in the military, the people in uniform, Vietnam syndrome is the fear of getting involved in a war you can't escape. So add to that drone syndrome, which is the belief that you can wage war without putting boots on the ground. That combination sends a signal to the rest of the world that the most powerful military the world has ever seen is sitting on the bench. That's a risky posture, because even if you don't want to go to war, no one wants to go to war, you have to make your enemies and your allies think that you are ready and willing. So now looking at politics, which is war by other means, or in Washington, the sport of nerds. Anti-war stance of Obama, too, is probably good politics for the moment. The economy is the biggest threat to national security. There's no stomach, no budget for another prolonged war like Iraq or Afghanistan. Much of the supposed savings programmed ahead are set to come out of the military budget. So you might have noticed that up to this point, I've barely mentioned the Republicans, either in domestic policy or in foreign policy. That's because they have marginalized themselves, painted themselves into a corner, and then shot themselves in the foot. How is it possible, really, that any incumbent president won re-election with this kind of economy? Every known law of politics was broken. Nobody was supposed to be able to win with unemployment that high and consumer confidence that low. People were being thrown out of their homes, plants were closing, and nest eggs disappeared. The federal budget itself was upside down. On election day, Obama had higher disapproval ratings than both Bushes, Jimmy Carter, and Ronald Reagan on their elections. The unemployment rate hadn't been that high on election day since 1980, yet Obama pulled it off. The Republican weakness in the campaign has carried over into the new government in 2013. If you think of the three branches of government, the White House, Congress, the court, the Republicans control only half of one third. And by control, I mean in numbers only. John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, is a very likable person, smart politician, but he's got the toughest job in town. The Republicans can't agree on what their strategy is, what their tactics should be, or who should lead them. So can anybody tell me who is the leader of the Republican Party now? Mitt Romney disappeared. Newt Gingrich vanished. Chris Christie, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, not yet. So it shouldn't be this way. Republicans should have a great message for today. They're supposed to be the party of economic opportunity, the grown-ups who can balance a budget and meet a payroll, the party of Ronald Reagan, mourning in America. So maybe that's the problem. Maybe they're looking backward toward Reagan instead of forward to the Latino family that owns a little grocery store, or the African-American single mom who doesn't want a handout but wants a job, the young person who was born after Reagan left office, graduated from college with good grades, and is working at Starbucks. President Obama says all the time that we're faced with a fundamental choice between the two parties, especially over the role of government. The country is split between the two choices, but the Republicans have failed to articulate a vision that includes everybody. They failed to put up good candidates, and they've allowed the opposition to paint them as the party of the rich and the racist, which they are not. So, the final topic, the people who aid and abet the crimes of the Capitol, the media. So how much are the media responsible for our political and economic problems? Why does what we call reporting today sound like what we used to call opinion? Why is there so much arguing on television? Why is there so much nastiness, so many personal attacks? Most of us here are old enough to remember when each town had one or two newspapers. There were three television networks, and they each had 30 minutes of news a day. People in Scripps remember the debates over going to an hour of news. But that was controversial, going from 30 minutes to an hour. And people said, no way, if there's not enough news in the whole world to fill up an hour. So since then, we've managed to program hundreds of hours on many more channels. CNN filled an appetite for breaking news. Fox filled an appetite among people who saw liberal bias in the mainstream media. MSNBC filled an appetite among people who hate Fox News. Then there's news online. From the left, the Huffington Post. On the right, the Drudge Report. Thousands of Twitter feeds where you can find just your own taste in news. Facebook allows people to share their favorite stories from any media outlet. At the same time, we see this fragmentation of audience. There's a decline in revenue from our traditional source, advertising. Newspaper ad revenue peaked in 2005 at about $50 billion for the whole industry. And honestly, I wish somebody had told me that 2005 was going to be the peak, the best year. I really would have enjoyed it more. And by the way, that's right before Alan left. So coincidence? I don't know. In 5 years, from $50 billion in 2005, 5 years later, total newspaper advertising, print and online, was cut in half. During that time, this is the ironic part, more people had access to more news more often in more places than any time in human history. So what happened was our traditional business model came unhinged from our product and our customers. We were swarmed by newcomers, raided by pirates, devalued by irrational competitors, enabled by new technologies. It's become a free-for-all, where anyone can call themselves a journalist and anyone can be a publisher. The trashier the story, the higher the traffic, the more the revenue. One of the Scripps editors says that old newspaper people like us trying to compete in this environment is like a guy in a leisure suit and a comb-over going to a singles bar. He is not going to get lucky. But this is not to excuse how we behave, just to partially explain it. I remember standing over the shoulder of a reporter during the Clinton impeachment. Everybody had some detail about Monica Lewinsky. Honestly, I can't remember what it was. It was so important at the time. And I'm banging on the guy, you got to get that. You got to match that story. It's embarrassing. Everybody has it and we don't have it. He wouldn't budge. I honestly was on top of him. He wouldn't budge. He said, it's not solid. I don't have it. And I was thinking, I don't really care how solid it is. Everybody else has it. Thank God. He held his ground, wouldn't do it. Of course, it turned out to be wrong. Everybody else had to correct it, and then they moved on. But not only are the facts shaky, just look at all of the wrong information that came out of the Newtown shooting. But news comes packaged inside an agenda. In the old days, when we served all the people, or we felt like we were supposed to serve all the people, we prided ourselves on telling it straight. It wasn't just a moral decision, it was a business necessity. When our audience now is fragmented into niches of people who all see the world the same way, the new business necessity seems to be to tell them what they want to hear. So I used to think that people would believe what they read or not. Now I'm convinced that they'll only read what they already believe. So where does that leave the good citizens of this great country? How can we find the truth when we're swimming in a sea of disinformation, rumor, and quackery? I got four ideas for you. First, media literacy. It's easier than ever to see who and what interests are behind a particular story or a media organization. Where I started my career at the City News Bureau of Chicago, they had one motto. If your mother tells you that she loves you, check it out. So, I brought my own mom here. You can ask her. So, be skeptical about what you read. If you get an email from someone claiming to be your son-in-law's neighbor's cousin who is in Afghanistan, says that if you just send them $1,000, they'll give you $100 million in gold bullion that was left over, well, you should be skeptical, right? Or at City, like they say at City News, you should check it out. Same with all the stories. Second, get out of your comfort zone. If you only read the Wall Street Journal, give the New York Times a try. At least, as my sister-in-law says, to know what the enemy is up to. If you only watch CNN, try Fox News once in a while. Here's some websites to try. Huffington Post, Drudge Report, The Atlantic, Politico, The Guardian, RealPolitics.com, The Sunlight Foundation. Get on Twitter and Facebook. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to post any personal information. No one's going to steal your credit card or your soul. It's perfectly fine just to get on and watch everybody else. Honestly, that's what I do. Third, support what you love. If you love the symphony, you write a check. If you love your church, you write a check. If you appreciate a media organization, I'm not going to say if you love a media organization, if you appreciate it, show your support with money. You're all going to get more of a chance in the near future to do that. Fourth, be patient. That the old order has collapsed, but the new order has not risen. I believe that the value of true and honest information has never been greater. I also believe that the new technologies allow everybody to have access to that truth. The piece that's missing is the business model that will support professional journalists. Probably it's going to be some combination of advertising and subscriptions. It used to be almost all advertising, a little bit on subscriptions. It's going to maybe be 50-50 or more towards subscriptions. When the internet was born, the mantra was information wants to be free. Well, it may want to be free, but the people who produce the highest quality journalism have to make a living. And I believe journalism is a profession, a science dedicated to the quick, honest, and fair presentation of the facts. I'm not saying that's what it always is. That's what I believe that it should be. Science, quick, honest, fair presentation of the facts. I believe that opinion has a role in journalism, but the best opinion, like the best science, is supported by verifiable facts. I have great confidence that the media world will sort itself out. Likewise, I have great confidence that our political leaders will muddle through with small agreements, compromises, and half measures. Mostly, I believe that the American people, who ultimately will determine what kind of media and what kind of politicians we have, will be smart, have good values, and will lead us into a brighter future. So I'm pretty confident the country will be right. But when I started, I told you that I was worried about something else, something closer to home. So here's what it is. This is what I want to learn from you. On December 31st, as Alan mentioned, Let me try it again. 33 years in the news business,
Retired.
Okay, I don't feel tired. I don't even know what retired means. I honestly can't say it. People ask me, what are you doing? What I was hoping is, if y'all have your name cards, and if you have one piece of advice, write it on the name card, and then give it to me or somebody from the club, and I'll get it. This is an honest thing. And if they're really good, we could do the Forum Club Book of Retirement Success. So thanks again for having me. I know that you've submitted questions. Alan's going to read them. And I appreciate your having me back again. Thank you. Thanks.
Okay. Peter, thank you very much. And it almost sounds like the beginning of an invitation to come back in 20 more years with these suggestions. Please take these books from us and add them to your collection from 20 years ago as a memento of being here. And thanks again for presentations.
Thank
Alan?
Thank you.
Let's ask some questions.
I think I'm about to prove your points. We have very strong points of view represented in this room. And let me read one that I'd never heard before. Obama won 13 of 14 states in play. These 13 did not require voters to present photo ID. Therefore, anyone could vote multiple times. I'm not sure I agree with that premise, by the way. Each of the 13 states won by 51% to 49%. Fraud won the election.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. But I do agree that this is an issue that hasn't resolved itself. Where I live in the District of Columbia, we're not required to show anything. And it was complete chaos. And I went in to vote, and I wanted to show some ID. And I brought my voter registration card, and they're like, oh, no. What's your name again? Here's a ballot and go. Maybe I could have voted twice. I did not. But there were enough watchdogs out there. Both sides had huge platoons of lawyers in every contested area that were looking for fraud. And all of the media organizations had special teams dedicated to this, too, because we thought it was going to be a problem. And I didn't see it. I've been to a lot of countries. I lived in Mexico for 5 years. I lived in Chicago. I know about vote fraud. So I'm going to agree to disagree on that one. But I do think that it's something, and you all know what it is that it's a Republican and Democrat thing, that the Democrats believe that the more people that come out, the more they'll get. And Republicans believe that the more of that their people have IDs, and it's not an issue for them. So it's a political issue.
And I'm going to get rid of these particularly adversarial questions quickly so we can get to other things. I've got two questions about Hillary, and they're very related. Why didn't Hillary tell us what happened at Benghazi? And the second one was Hillary covering up for someone on her staff like a Kennedy?
So she has 70,000 people that work at the State Department. I remember when Colin Powell was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he told me, he said, there are 1.2 million people in uniform. That I can be absolutely convinced at any given moment one of them is doing something incredibly stupid. So there was a big mistake in Benghazi. And What happened was, I think, that they got caught up in the euphoria of the revolution in Libya, and that we were, for the first time, seen as partners in this new enterprise. And I think people let their guard down. I don't know if it was all the way at her level, but if in the grand scheme of the things that she's paid to worry about, that consulate was a small thing. And now, in hindsight, it looks like a terrible mistake. What was there another part of that?
Well, but about a cover-up.
A cover-up. Yes, in the sense that you don't want to throw anybody under the bus. But there were four or five people who were forced to resign after that happened. Sorry?
They're
protecting. Yes. I mean, they all rally around each other. That's true.
I'm going to change subjects a little bit. I don't know why they think you're the expert on all these subjects, but let me try one more, and then we'll get to the meat that you can deal with more logically. But please comment on the Wall Street Journal's editorial on the escalating cost of RomneyCare in Massachusetts, and why will the federal version be even more financially out of control?
So one thing I always was reluctant to do as a reporter was try to predict the future. But you can look at how programs work in one place, like RomneyCare. I don't know. I mean, it seems to me like it's going to be really expensive, but I'm hesitant to try to predict what the future is going to be.
I think you tried to answer this in your talk, Peter, but how does traditional media compete with me-first reporting from blogs like Gawker and Twitter and reporters with less rules of responsible reporting? And I think you answered that, but if you want to take another shot at it, go right ahead.
Yeah, it's good and bad. When I ran the news service, we publish about 60 columnists who are syndicated to 400 newspapers all around the country. And so every day someone would pitch a column to me and say, I write this column about health or about education or religion, and I want to be syndicated. And for many years I had and people like me had a powerful role as gatekeeper, that we would decide based on our intuition or our surveys of the market on what you would read in your newspapers. So people still call and ask to be syndicated, and I just tell them, you don't need me anymore. There is no gate that a gatekeeper is blocking. That if you want to write a column, put it online, and it will sell or not sell based on the popularity. Now, whether you can make money from that is another thing. So that's the good part of it, that it's not a small number of people in Washington or New York controlling what's in the media, that it's pretty wide open. So the bad part is all of the garbage that's out there. But there are some really talented people who just didn't study journalism, they didn't get in the business, they went up, maybe some in this room came up in another career, but they have good thoughts, they're able to articulate them well. And to me, it's fabulous that people can do that.
What is the future of print?
I think better than we all report. I was reading the Naples Daily News today. There were no stories in that print product that you couldn't get online, but it's a nice experience to have it on paper, I think. And that may be a reflection of my age a little bit, but we're all going to live a long time. More loyal print readers. I think that it's going to be a smaller market. You'll have to pay more for your print newspaper, but it'll continue to exist as one thing. When radio was invented, people thought newspapers would go out of business, because why would you read something if you could just sit there and have someone read it to you? And then when TV came along, people said, well, radio is going to go out of business, because why would you just listen to something if you could watch it? But the existing media kind of got shoved aside, and it expanded the menu. So people they seem to have an unlimited ability to consume, that there's more information out there, but people have expanded what they think they need to know. So I'm thinking hoping that it's okay.
This is a student question. In your time as a journalist, did you find an importance in not only a written portion but a visual element when covering a story?
Yes. And one thing Alan taught me when I was just starting out was And this is a thing for visual journalism and all journalism, that when you're going to take a picture of something, you have to decide where do you stand. And then that's also something that you should think about when you're reporting a story in general, that where do you stand. I remember that piece of advice.
Well, I don't, but I appreciate it.
You should try it.
Yeah. Something happens when you get my age. I want to introduce someone now. Dave Neal, the publisher of the Naples Daily News. As you might imagine, there are quite a few questions here. And I at least want you to stand here and listen to them so they can see your face react.
That's right.
Come on. The first question is, they were going to try to get Peter to take the blame for this, but he doesn't deserve it. So why does the Naples Daily News support the left in a conservative town?
I'm out of here.
I'm sorry, no more questions. We're out of time.
Let me help you.
Thank you.
It's not true. Occasionally they slipped off the wagon, but mostly they're conservative.
Thank you, Alan. Yeah. Thank you.
Wait a minute. Don't go yet. With the Naples Daily News printed here, what percentage, and I can't read the writing, but essentially what percentage of the time are the presses actually productive?
They would be running. Is it percentage?
Well, however you want to do it.
They would be running about 30% of any given day. So if anyone is interested in bringing commercial printing to our presses, we'd love to talk to you. So thank you.
I think, just a plug for the Naples Daily News, they have, without a doubt, the best presses of any newspaper in the country right now. And it would be nice if they could use them more. I'm going to let you go.
Thank you.
I'll get back to Peter. I just wanted you to meet Dave because he's been in Naples a few years. He recently became publisher just within the last couple of years. He's one of the best publishers we've ever had, and he's sitting over next to the best we ever had, Corbin Wyan, who's a longtime member of this club. The final question, this is to show you that we do have some age and experience in this audience with a long memory. How can the military-industrial complex be downsized per Dwight Eisenhower's warning? I'm not sure I agree with the premise, but
yeah. What he meant was that there was this, and not a conspiracy, but a definite commingling of interests between industry and the military. That if the more threats we had, the more equipment we would have to build. And that's still true. I remember covering the B-2 bomber, with the most expensive plane at the time. And the contractors built a, they showed a map, and it showed how they had a part in every single, being built in every single congressional district. And that they were proud of it, and it was just part of their defensive strategy. So it still exists, and it's bigger than at ever. I mean, you definitely saw it. Did anybody see any political commercials during the campaign? Man, if you come down, Florida was really bad. So there's a ton of money, more than ever, going into the political system. It's not good. If anybody has an alternative, I welcome.
I just want everyone to compliment Peter on the quality person that he is, and his integrity and his honesty.
Thanks.
Was very apparent in his remarks today. And I'm so proud that you are part of my former
Thanks.
Company, because I love it.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Peter, thank you again. Thank you all for being here, and we'll see you all February 8th for General Conway.